24/7 or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David.
What's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting is being held.
KBOO is loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Sarah Blanco, contributing producer, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Communities Against Carbon Transport and Injection, also known as CACTI, will talk to us about a proposed carbon waste pipeline in California. Polluters get paid to dump their waste, and a private company gets paid to pipe it through wetlands. Not unique to California, this has caused disaster in Satartia, Mississippi, all under the guise of addressing climate change. Also, we'll speak with Dr. Aisha Juman, who returns from a recent trip to Yemen. We have an uplifting conversation despite the tragedy that her homeland faces as they stand up for Gaza. And we'll close the show with Yasmin Rahimi, who joins us to share a poem from her Afghan and Colombian roots. All this straight ahead. Hello, everyone. You're listening to Flashpoints. I am Sarah Blanco, contributing producer, and I'm sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. Joining us now are Isabel Penman, a Northern California organizer with Food and Water Watch, Also, we have Victoria Bogdan Tejeda, staff attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity. Welcome to the both of you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much.
We're getting ahead of a September 9th press conference concerning a proposed carbon pipeline. And this press conference is going to be in Fairfield, California, but this is something that affects us all across the country. Talk to us a little bit about the collaboration between Bay Area residents and environmental organizations that are putting on this press conference and why.
Bay Area residents and health advocates, environmental advocates are coming together because Montezuma LLC is proposing a super dangerous and unnecessary 45-mile pipeline right near communities and sensitive wetlands, putting people and the really important wildlife there at risk. This proposed pipeline infrastructure threatens our public health across the Bay Area, especially Contra Costa and Solano County. And so that's why, community groups, these frontline communities are coming together to stand up and address these concerns and talk about why this project is so dangerous and why we should oppose it.
Tell us about what the carbon pipeline is.
Sure. So I can take that. What this is about is a technology called carbon capture and storage. And the premise of carbon capture and storage is to put equipment on a smokestack. So any of us who've driven by, a factory or a refinery or a power plant have seen the really tall smokestack where emissions go out into the air. And the idea is to put some equipment on there that will capture the carbon dioxide that is produced by whatever the industrial process is, to capture that, to compress it together, and then to transport that in a pipeline to an injection well, like how we have oil and gas wells, but this would be an injection well to dump the pollution waste. And while that may sound like a good idea, like wouldn't we rather put that underground than to have it released into the air? There are a whole host of problems with that. Mainly, this technology has been around for a long time, decades. It first was used in the 1970s, and now it's being iterated around the world. And it just doesn't live up to that promise of being a climate solution, first and foremost. So there's never been a project even proposed that would capture 100% of the emissions. And so then you have a project capturing some of the emissions, but the amount of energy to compress that carbon is tremendous. And so we're seeing projects proposed in California that would build a whole new gas-fired power plant just to compress the carbon. And then once it's compressed, as Isabel mentioned, it is a highly dangerous substance. This isn't the CO2 that you have in your fizzy beverages. This is industrial scale, mass amounts of CO2 that can suffocate people if there's a leak for miles around. So we're not talking if there's a pipeline rupture or a leak at the injection well, the impact lasting just feet. This can spread for miles and cause suffocation and other harms, including death. So there are a host of problems with this, and it essentially is all falling under a public subsidy that pays polluters to emit pollution. So it actually disincentivizes other ways of reducing climate-harming emissions. And that's the project that is being proposed here in the Bay Area. What we know about this particular project is that there is a developer in Berkeley who has purchased private land in Solano County and is going to put the CO2 injection dumping well there. And so where does the CO2 or carbon dioxide come from? And in the permit applications, what we're seeing is that they're proposing to capture the pollution from different industrial sources along the Carquinez Strait. So that's in Contra Costa County, possibly on the north side of the bay, and to capture it, first of all, the one committed client so far, according to the permit application, is the PG&E gas-fired power plant in Antioch, and then to move that across the bay via pipeline to the injection well in Solano County.
Just to play devil's advocate, and you touched on it briefly, because the power plant, for example, is already there, because there are already a variety of different polluters all along the delta and the river where, you know, in Antioch is where the Sacramento and the San Joaquin River meet. An amazing shipping channel, very, very deep channel, beautiful area. But because there are already a bunch of companies there, why would it not be a good idea to have them try something to capture some of that pollution?
Well, even if we don't know how they will power that compression, they will need energy for that. And so whether it is building new power plants or drawing more energy off of the grid that could drive up the electricity rates for local customers, that's a bad idea. And then maybe Isabel wants to talk about the dangers of the pipeline, especially what happens when you have a pipeline in or near a water source.
Yeah, a big portion of our concerns about this project have to do with public safety. As Victoria mentioned, CO2 is a very special chemical, and when it interacts with water, it becomes extremely corrosive. So when we're talking about a 45-mile pipeline underwater, the smallest amount of water can really be a huge risk to the infrastructure that, you know, protects the drinking water and the ecosystems and the communities that live nearby. And obviously, humans always breathe some amount of carbon dioxide, but too much actually causes asphyxiation, disorientation, heart malfunction, and even in extreme exposures to CO2 can lead to death by asphyxiation. And so carbon dioxide, especially in open air, disperses. And because it is heavier than air, it flows along the landscape and expands. So it's not concentrated. It's not a concentrated gas explosion right at the site of a pipeline. It can go for miles and miles, the clouds of CO2, and can hang in the air for a long time. Another characteristic of CO2 is that it displaces oxygen, and that's what makes it an asphyxiant. And this is extremely important when it comes to public safety and emergency response, because combustion engines need oxygen to work. And we've seen this happen before in a case in Satarsha, Mississippi, but the CO2 displaces the oxygen in the air and the cars stop running. So even emergency vehicles can't get to the scene on time. Another important characteristic that makes this so concerning is that CO2 is odorless and colorless. So it's very, very hard to detect when a leak does occur.
And you mentioned Satarsha, Mississippi. Can you tell us a little bit more about the background of that tragedy there?
Yes. In 2020, there was a devastating CO2 pipeline rupture in Satarsha, Mississippi, a pretty small rural town that led actually to federal government deciding we needed to overhaul and update our federal pipeline regulations around CO2 transport. It ultimately caused a plume of CO2 to engulf the community. Within minutes, dozens of residents collapsed in their homes and vehicles. Cars stalled, including emergency vehicles, trying to reach the scene. And they ended up hospitalizing 45 Satarsha residents and forced a bit over 200 to evacuate their homes. That's when Congress mandated that CO2 pipeline approval on the federal level be paused until they could update those safety regulations. And actually, in California, with the passing of our own law, SB 905, in 2022, California followed suit and put a moratorium on our own CO2 pipeline build-out, all in response to this really disastrous leak that happened in Satarsha, more rural town. And this leak happened in the day. Some of the emergency responders who were on the scene had mentioned that if this had taken place at night, we would have been dealing with a lot of more casualties and increased public health risks, just because people would have been asleep in their homes. And like I said, the CO2 is odorless and colorless, and it would have been even worse than the incident that did occur and result in the overhaul of federal regulations that we currently have that have yet to be updated.
Anything you'd like to add to that, Victoria?
I think just to say that The public safety concerns are tremendous and huge. And there are concerns for rural areas where these projects are going in, and concerns for densely populated areas. And with this particular project, the company has to model the spread of the CO2 plume that they inject underground. So CO2, if it leaks above ground, can spread for miles, but once you inject that waste, it also spreads for miles underground. And one particularly frightening and concerning thing that we've seen is in that model, it shows the plume spreading out from Solano County underneath the Carquinez Strait and reaching Antioch. And when it gets to Antioch, the actual model that we see in the permit application right now just has question marks on that line, saying that their modeling doesn't know yet what would happen when that CO2 plume goes under Antioch, and that CO2 is buoyant. So if there's any conduit up to the surface, like a fault line, which we have a lot of, or any kind of well or something else, then that's when you can have a leak, and that could put people at risk.
Just can't leave the water alone, right? A lot of these environmental disasters often happen in areas where, you know, people of color live, where we might not have as much money as other people. I want to talk a little bit about Montezuma LLC, because they're the ones who want to build this pipeline. However, I was also reading about how Montezuma owns a significant portion of wetlands. And they were actually given, was it Measure AA funds, to take the dredging from a variety of places in California, like where areas needed to be dredged, I believe like the Oakland Port, for example. And so the idea is that they're putting all of this dredged soil, I'm assuming untested, just whatever it is, just dumping it to create this wetland. And their idea was that they could restore the tides and restore the wetlands a lot faster if they could just make it level again. Okay, it's like, you know, an engineer's mind, ingenuity meets restoration, meets you had enough money to buy the land to begin with. And then the connections that you have, you know, dredging in and of itself is an issue, but humans seem to surpass animals in sea life, right? Like we must get through, commerce must get through. What can you tell us about that particular project and anything else you'd like us to know specifically about how that and the pipelines may or may not be connected?
Sure. So you are correct that this would be happening on the property owned by the developer, Jim Levine, who did wetlands restoration. And so I find it a bit bewildering that there was this wetlands restoration and now the property will be used for a waste dumping site. And in the permit application materials, and just to be clear, the project has to get a permit from the federal EPA, that's for the carbon injection well, and from Solano County, that's at the land use level where we would see some CEQA review at some point in the future. So in the permit review that we've seen so far, the developer is saying that the injection will take place a mile inland, a mile away from the wetland area. But, and in the same area, we see Solano County has the area categorized as within the Sassoon Marsh Management Area. And there was a biological survey that showed that there are 8 special status wildlife species. So that means threatened or endangered or candidate species that are likely to occur in the area. 1 special status plant species, and then it's within the watershed area of the Delta Smelt. So, you know, this isn't just a brownfield area. This is an area that has been important for wildlife and is near communities. So that's where this proposed dumping site will go, which is a tad bewildering.
And can anyone speak to some of these environmental organizations or bodies that are funding or propelling or pushing for projects like things that Montezuma LLC is doing?
Sure, I can start. And then maybe Isabel, if you want to add on. So for this particular project, we saw information that the project is partnering with UC Berkeley and Lawrence Berkeley National Labs on some of the engineering pieces. And it becomes complicated because one may say, well, why would supposedly venerable institutions partner with a project that could be such a danger to the community? And it is, in our opinion, because this is billed as a climate solution when we've explained that it's not. And I work with scientists, and when I joined my organization, I talked a lot with those scientists about why carbon capture and storage is not a climate fix, and they've dug into the literature. And often we look at the United Nations climate body, abbreviated as the IPCC, and they come out every several years with recommendations for how to prevent the worst of the climate crisis. And they have modeled pathways, as they're called, to keep our climate crisis, you know, below the 1.5 degree amount of warming temperature. So they have modeled pathways that do not include carbon capture and storage. And the way to achieve those pathways is to justly transition away from fossil fuels, to increase reliance on renewables, and to use things like natural carbon sequestration, so replenishing our soils, regenerating our grasslands, investing in our forests, not these mechanical means that use lots of energy, that could cause vast devastation, and that haven't been shown to prove out and to work. So I don't know if, Isabel, you want to add anything to all of that.
Yeah, I guess I will just add and underscore the groups that, you know, are concerned, and the people who are making up the folks who are, you know, most threatened by this project. And it is a lot of folks who live in Contra Costa and Solano County, where the project is proposed. It's organizations like San Francisco Physicians for Social Responsibility, which represents healthcare workers who are extremely concerned about the public health risks, and environmental and conservation organizations, for example, San Francisco Baykeeper, who's extremely concerned about the risks to our precious waterway. Victoria mentioned, you know, the importance of the delta and questioning the site for why would you propose this kind of project in such a critical ecosystem in our area. The wetlands are one of the largest wetlands that we have in North America. And, you know, this ecosystem is extremely, extremely critical to the well-being of, you know, our agriculture and our drinking water and multiple endangered species, as Victoria mentioned. But I do think it's important also to note that this project is extremely close to very populated communities. And what they look for in the geology of certain places to put the CO2 is cavernous areas that will be good for storing the CO2 underneath the ground. And unfortunately, this geology matches where oil and gas is often found. And so what we're seeing in the state of California is these projects being proposed in historically environmental justice communities that have already dealt with oil and gas drilling for the past decades. And we see this in the Montezuma project. This pipeline matches and it goes along the what we call the refinery corridor. So we mentioned the PG&E gas, fracked gas power plant, also the Chevron refinery in Richmond, and communities here have long been exposed to CO2 emissions and have been fighting the air pollution that has come from these fossil fuel facilities for so, so long already, and are now being inundated with these project proposals for a second wave of, you know, fossil fuel infrastructure that will just increase the risks that they're being exposed to.
And you're listening to Flashpoints. I'm Sarah Blanco, contributing producer, and we are discussing a carbon waste dumping project near the Montezuma wetlands in the Bay Area, but, you know, similar pipelines could be coming to a site near you. I'd like to ask, what are some actual carbon pollution solutions? What could we be looking at instead of the so-called science of piping the carbon underground?
Sure. So we have the answers for this, and scientists around the world have agreed that we need to justly transition away from fossil fuels, and that includes fossil fuel energy generation. And we have the technologies. We have solar, which can be distributed locally in neighborhoods. It doesn't always have to be giant utility scale solar out in the desert. We have wind and other forms of power generation, and also, as I mentioned, the natural forms of carbon sequestration. And the challenges is that those are difficult. Those will require tough choices and changes in society, but the science tells us that those are the choices that we have to make, not prolong these existing polluting industries. And I mentioned before that what has made carbon capture and storage so popular in recent years is that there's a big public subsidy, and polluters get paid for every ton of CO2 that they inject into the ground, whether or not they inject it to store or whether or not they inject it to take more fossil fuels out of the ground. So right now, our incentives are in the entirely wrong place to move in the direction of the solutions that we need.
Thank you. So following the money as well, and knowing when actions are taking place in our area, because these things are literally happening in our sleep. Please tell us more about the September 9th press conference.
Community members, Bay Area residents, homeowners, healthcare professionals are coming together to show the fossil fuel industry and our state leaders that we're not going to be silenced as dangerous carbon dumping and pipeline infrastructure is being proposed in our backyard. So on September 9th, we will be convening outside of the Solano County Board of Supervisors building to really show that we are standing up and not wanting Solano County to be used as this testing ground for this experimental project and dumping ground for fossil fuel pollution. Solano County Board of Supervisors are one of the decision makers who will be deciding on permits for this project. And so we're going to use this as an opportunity to urge them to not let Montezuma LLC build this very dangerous pipeline in our backyards and reject all attempts to move these dumping projects forward here in Solano County and across the state. We deserve a thriving, sustainable local economy that doesn't rely on refineries and pollution and extraction. And so that's really what that day is going to be about. And we're very excited to launch Cacti, or Communities Against Carbon Transport and Injection, on that day during this press conference. And you'll be able to hear from local residents who live right where this project is being proposed. You'll be able to hear from healthcare professionals speak about the public health risks that this project poses. And we're very excited that we'll be having this press conference and really just be demanding that our priority needs to be an immediate community-driven just transition away from fossil fuels.
Thank you. That's Isabel Penman from Food and Water Watch. Any closing words from Victoria? Victoria Bogdan Tejeda is from the Center for Biological Diversity.
I would say that now is the time to, if folks are concerned about this, talk to your local leaders, because a lot of local leaders we've encountered are hearing the industry talking points about carbon capture and storage, and often, many times, wanting to do the right thing. They want to do something about climate change, at least here in California. And so it's up to all of us to help educate them about what are real and what are false solutions to that. And carbon capture and storage is a false solution.
Thank you both for coming out and talking to us about this press conference. Thank you for the work you do and for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. We'll be back after this short music break. You are listening to Flashpoints. I am contributing producer Sarah Blanco, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. Today, we want to be present for Yemen. And joining us is Aisha Juman. Aisha is currently working as an independent consultant, coordinating health-related projects in Yemen. Aisha Juman has over 30 years of experience in public health. Aisha has also worked in her native home of Yemen. One example is working with the United Nations Population Fund. She has also participated in health-related program development, evaluation, and training activities for Peace Corps. Aisha earned her PhD in epidemiology from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, her master's in public health from Emory University, and her BA biology from Mills College in Oakland. I wanted to give that bio because of the expansiveness of what you do, and I want to thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you, Sarah.
And you are radiating goodness today. I can sense it in your voice. So I want to really start out by talking about what's on your mind today, right now.
Yeah, so there's a lot on my mind today. But one of the things that I keep going back to is Yemen, of course, because of all the things that are happening there, but also despite all the heartbreaks that we see in Yemen, there are so many signs for optimism. There are so many signs to showing people's resilience in Yemen, and especially women. And that's what fills me with joy, actually. I just came back from Yemen, where I spent 7 weeks. And despite the deteriorating economic situation in Yemen, one positive sign that I saw, and it was very uplifting, is to see how many women have decided to go into the workforce and not work for someone else, but be entrepreneur and start their own businesses. This is something that I really connected with and just loved. I remember I would stumble sometimes on these businesses. I was in a neighborhood where I visited my cousin and saw this bakery. It's just, you know, a small bakery. And I stopped to ask for bread and met this woman who was probably in her late 20s. She's the owner of the bakery, and she makes her own bread and she sells it as well. So she has all kind of bread that I have not been able to find in regular bakeries in Yemen. She was baking bread that I grew up on. In Yemen, we have over 40 types of bread that we make. We make bread with lentil. We make bread with barley. We make different kinds of breads where we put so many grains, multi-grain bread. And so I started talking to her, asking her where she was from. Then she was far from where I live, but her bread was amazing. And again, so I'll drop by every single day to say hello to her, chat, and buy the bread. And sometimes I'll get there and I'm too late because the bread had been all sold out, some of the varieties. So I tell her, please, you know, tomorrow, just keep this for me, and I'll stop by. Another one was a neighbor who I had known for many, many years. And she came to say hello to me because I was visiting and brought 10 pieces. And in Yemen, we make bread round and thin, so it's not the normal American or European bread. It's the flat bread. Oh my God, I fell in love with it immediately. It's a multi-grain bread that had barley, it had wheat, it had, trying to think of the name, so two other kind of grains in them. And so I said, okay, did you make this? And she said, yeah, I make it. I said, if I want to buy from you, would you be selling? She said, yeah, I'd be happy. And I said, what else do you make? She said, oh, I make everything. So guess what? Almost every other day, she made these amazing cookies that are filled with dates. They're so crunchy and fresh. And she will deliver it. She will deliver it to the home. She will have her husband. So I'll call her at night and say, hey, you know, can you make this for me in 2 days? She said, oh, if you want to tomorrow, I can make it for you tomorrow. I remember the first time I ordered from her, she just said yes, but then 2 days passed and I didn't get anything from her. So I called and I said, hey, what's going on? And then I figured she didn't have the money to buy the ingredients. So it's like, okay, I'm going to pay you ahead of time. Why don't you go buy the ingredients and then you can make it? And sure enough, within less than 24 hours, products were delivered. And so now I understand I'm back home in Seattle and that all my family members and friends are ordering from her. There are other women who also make food. So there's one woman that is famous for making stuffed vegetables. So a friend of mine told me about her. So I contacted her and she sent me all these pictures of the different vegetables she was stuffing. And so it's just that kind, and even as simple as making a thermos of coffee or tea, and Yemeni tea is very famous as well. And she, these women will stand in the streets, at the, you know, sidewalk, and you go and they just have this thermos and, you know, paper cup, and you buy from them. And I've seen women sell school supplies because the school had started. And so it just, anytime I would see a woman in the sidewalk, to, you know, selling something, or I'm like, I would stop by, we'll chat and get a little bit to know about her. And one of them was most impressive because she lived in the village, but she would drive every single day to Sana'a, and she had fruit trees in her yard, apparently. And so she would drive this pickup truck to Sana'a and we'll sell them from the pickup truck. And I was just like, oh my God, I could not believe it. And so I talked to her and, you know, she was like, oh, you look like my mom. And her mom had just passed. So we hugged and kissed and I will go. And again, because I saw her as I was driving and I'm like, I need to stop. It's a woman selling fruits. I can buy from her. And she was really far. It's like about half an hour away from my parents' house where I was staying. But sure enough, you know, I would stop quite often. And she was extremely honest. Like, I loved figs. And it was fig season. And there are so many varieties of figs. And I, of course, as humans, we like to buy the ones that look big and look good. And she had these very small, dusty kind of figs. And she said, no, no, buy this. And I'm like, you know, they don't look too appealing. She said, try it. She puts one in my mouth. I'm like, ooh, this is really a good thing. She said, yeah, I would not sell you the other ones. This is what you need to buy. So it's just those stories where women have decided, you know, because as you know, with the war and the bombing, a lot of men, young men, especially those who were able to, you know, bring income to the families had been killed. So women are just going out and doing their own things to help with the Yemen Relief, which is an organization I founded. It's a relief organization. And I'm the president of. We also support a lot of women with income generation projects. So we buy either sewing machines for women. Women in the villages, we buy them goats or sheep or chicken, whatever they want in those areas. We've supported a lot of women to start their own in-home bakery. And it was really nice. I stopped at this very small grocery store and he had a section where the bakery goods were from the woman, one of the women we had supported. I knew the name of her brand. So it was really nice to see that they, she, her product were being sold. And we also had brought women together. So like five women to work together and have a bakery. So we bought them all the equipment that they need, all the material that they needed. And they're doing very well. So it's just, again, during crisis, and I've always read, and because I love psychology, that during crisis, women are the ones who really carry the burden and emerge from it very well. And this, now I have a live example of that, where due to the crisis, women in Yemen have emerged as very strong, very resilient, you know, in the workforce and supporting themselves and their families.
Absolutely beautiful. I'm just envisioning all of this bread and what 40 different types of bread and fruit and figs and dates and the entrepreneurial spirit, but also we could say the ganas, the out there, the gumption and the getting it done. And yeah, could definitely sense that happiness in your voice, Aisha, because many times I know that when we have you at KPFA, we're discussing some incredibly distressing, almost unbearable times. But food, it has such a way to bring us together, because all of that ganas, that gumption, that emergence, that entrepreneurial spirit is built into what they're making fresh and then sharing it out and radiating. And here you are back in the U.S. and it's still radiating from you.
Yeah. And like you said, food brings people together. So when, you know, I would invite friends and, you know, have the food prepared and brought, and, you know, the larger family also bring them all together. So I have two sisters and two brothers, and we took turns inviting the whole family for a meal. So when it's my turn, so, you know, I did cook a few days, but instead of spending all the time cooking, I'm like, okay, I'm going to order for you. So I made one Friday, I decided I'm going to make breakfast. And because my husband is Lebanese, I decided that I'm going to make Lebanese breakfast. But instead of making it, I called this neighbor, but she doesn't know how to make it. So I made all the ingredients and sent them to her at 6 a.m. Her husband came, picked it up, and I told her exactly how to make it. And guess what? She made it. And we had a Lebanese breakfast for, you know, that day. And then my older brother invited us one day, my other sister, you know, so every member, you know, the siblings, we will invite the whole family. And my parents live in a multi-generational house. So we have my parents, and then my brothers live with them. And one of my brothers, his son and his daughter are married, and they live with them, and they have their kids there. So it's just such a treat to be working, you know, interacting with someone as young as 3 years to as old as my parents. And, you know, one day I decided, okay, I'm going to take the kids out to what is called a fun city, which is, you know, where they have a lot of games and activities. And it was just such pleasure to hear them laugh and run and, you know, coming to me and calling my name. And, you know, it's so you have that pleasure of playing with kids. I had, you know, with my siblings, we tease each other a lot. We you know, remembering our youth and childhood and what we did. And with my mom and dad, I also like to tease them because nobody in the family dare say anything to them except, yes, sir, yes, ma'am. So I come here and I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. We're going to have to challenge you a little bit. And my father would say, I don't want to hear you. Get out of my room. And my mom and say, get out of my face. I want your other sister to come.
Oh, my goodness.
They also say it laughingly because nobody teases them. So I come along and, you know, just challenge everybody. And it's just a lot of fun.
That's great. It's so great to hear the joy and to laugh with you. We would love for the whole conversation to be about communing and happiness. But as we talk about what you love to see about your native home, let's also talk about the latest Israeli attack that killed the prime minister and multiple officials. What does this mean for the world if we let this assassination be normalized?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Israel is breaking every international law without any consequences, without accountability. So I remember, you know, when we were reading history, how the League of Nations was dismantled because it didn't do what it was supposed to do, and that is prevent the World War II. We're seeing the same thing now. So the United Nations were replaced it to abide by the laws of war and the humanitarian laws. And so whether it's the Geneva Convention or whether it's the Rome Convention or all the UN rules regarding war or and humanitarian work, all of these had been broken by Israel. So basically, for me, why do we even need the United Nations today? Because it's supposed to stop the genocide that's happening in Gaza. It's supposed to force Israel to bring in food, stop the siege on Gaza. On the contrary, they're actually punishing anyone who stands against the genocide, whether at our universities here in the US or in Germany. And Yemen was the only country in the world that had decided to uphold international law and the Geneva Convention and the Rome Convention and UN Charter directives to not allow genocide and just try and stop it. So Yemen is being punished for upholding international law. That's just really so absurd. And like you said, I mean, the current attack on the prime minister's office and his cabinet in daylight. I mean, this is a prime minister's meeting and no condemnation from anyone. It just shows me that the rules are broken and that the Western and the US countries that are considered democracies just failed us and failed our citizens and failed the world in every aspect in this.
Can you talk about the prime minister? How did the people in general feel about the prime minister? I know that the funerals just occurred.
Right. So there was a huge outrage in Yemen over this. And if you just look at pictures of the funeral, you would see that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people came out to the funeral. This is something that should not have happened. This is something that, you know, there should be outcry for its happening. What a lot of people don't recognize is three of the people who were actually in Yemen, we call them martyred because they died for a cause and a just cause. And three of them were actually from the south. South of Yemen. Three of them were from the People's Congress, which is the party that was established by the previous president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh. So I always like to refer to the government in Sana'a as the government in Sana'a rather than Ansarullah's government or the Houthi's government, because it truly is a government that encompasses different people and different groups, political groups, and also even geographic groups. And so it's something that I think every single family in Yemen has felt. You know, I scroll through social media to see the responses of people in Yemen, and people feel sad and they feel outraged that this happened. And they honestly believe that these people have been martyred for a worthy cause. And so he's been, I think he was very much loved before, but now I think it's like a lot of people who spend their lives and give their lives for just causes, they become immortalized in people's hearts and memories.
I understand. Wouldn't it just be great to be allowed to live?
Yeah.
We're speaking with Aisha, and we've been talking about Yemen, the difficulties, the hardships, the wars on Yemen, but the resilience of the Yemeni people as well.
Yemen will prevail. Yemen, the Yemeni people are extremely resilient people. A country that has existed for thousands of years. Yemen is one of the oldest countries in the world. Sana'a city is declared by UNESCO as the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. Yemen is the place where the first cup of coffee was brewed. Just think of how many people drink coffee and they don't recognize the connection to Yemen. And that's where that cup of coffee came from. So I would say they have experienced lots of crises and disasters in their lives and in their history. And they have come through all of that and they survived all of that. I know that Yemen will survive this as well, whether it's the Israeli bombing, whether it's the US sanctions, whether everything that's being thrown at them. It doesn't mean that it's not painful. It is very painful. We've just lost so many people who are serving their countries and serving their people. And these are civilians. All of them are civilians and civilians' ministries. But again, the Yemenis are going to be even more defiant on this. They have made a lot of statements, whether it's from an average person in the streets or in the government in Sana'a, that this is not going to stop them. They will continue to support Gaza, and they will stop when the blockade on Gaza stops, when the genocide in Gaza stops. And we've seen them do that in the two short ceasefires that existed. They stopped all of this. So it's really, and now with the new report from genocide experts, that this is genocide. 86% of the people who voted on the expert panel, and all of them are Israeli or Jewish people who had families who suffered during the Holocaust. So for them to call this genocide, it's about time, I think, for the world to do something about it. And something is to stop it and stop it immediately and insist that people are not starved.
You're right, Aisha. It is about time. And before we wrap up, what are your closing thoughts for us today?
I think of the people like you, Sarah, that in Arabic we call them, it's medicine for the wounds, that heal our wounds. It's people like you and your listeners who make it easier for someone like me, knowing that there's daily strikes in Yemen and that my family is all there, to know that I'm not alone. That there are good people, and actually the majority of people are like you, but we're not the loudest. But I know that you, your listeners, and many people like you are kind-hearted, and that knowing that does really heal our wounds. And I'm not just saying that for myself, that even the people of Yemen I've talked to when I was in Yemen, both in the south and in the north, people do understand and distinguish between the American public and the administrations, whether it's the Biden administration or the Trump administration or the Obama administration. All of them have wronged Yemen and the Yemeni people. but people are keenly aware that that does not represent the American people.
I'm sure our listeners are thankful to hear that. That's so sweet of you to say, you're the eyes and the ears, the boots on the ground. You take good care, Aisha, and thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Stay tuned. We have a poem for you after this short music break. I'm Sarah Blanco, contributing producer sitting in for Dennis Bernstein.
America.
You've been listening to Flashpoints. I am contributing producer Sarah Blanco. We're going to close out the show this evening by talking with Yasmin Rahimi. Yasmin is a poet, amongst other things. Thank you for joining us on Flashpoints, Yasmin.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about all of the creative work that you're into.
Yeah, definitely. So as you mentioned, my name is Yasmin. I'm from Antioch, California. I am an event planner, an actor, a playwright, loosely labeled a poet. We're actually working on a play right now for a company called Monument Impact, and it is based on housing rights and immigration. Other than that, I have been writing for about a few years, and I've been introduced to poetry by Jose Cordon, who is actually Antioch's poet laureate and the founder of Grassroots Poetry. A little bit about myself is my background is Colombian and Afghan. My mom is Colombian. She spent some years there and between there and London before moving to Alameda at 16. And my dad is Afghan, and him and his parents and siblings came to America in the 90s. I realize that the older I get, the more I take pride in my background and the more I want to write about how beautiful the two are, especially because the two are very harshly stereotyped, I would say. And so I kind of like to bring awareness of how loving and beautiful it is.
Thank you so much. And that's something we've been trying to highlight whenever we can, the beauty and just the combination of being from Afghanistan and Colombian roots. It's just beautiful, beautiful no matter who you are. But to be able to share with us a poem about those roots, we're very honored, Yasmin, if you don't mind.
No, of course. So I wrote this piece. It's called Black Tea and Coffee. And it goes like this. I'm showered by the culture of black tea and coffee, from brinj and sabzi to empanadas and ají. From warm taste of buñuelos, the Colombian kind, to spices of Afghan food that could bring vision to the blind, I'm showered by the culture of black tea and coffee. From chivas and fincas to masjids and pomegranate trees, I come from Hakims and Sharifas and Luz Maria Mendozas from Bogota streets. I'm showered by the culture of black tea and coffee. And I'm filled with love from both sides, with the softness of nafasi modad and jigari modad, of mi vidas and mi preciosas and nicknames of all kinds. I'm shown with fresh cut fruit brought to my room and of duas that I make at home on time. I'm showered by the culture of black tea and coffee, heard in the prayers told to me every night before I lay my head down to sleep. In el nombre del Padre, del Hijo, y del Espíritu Santo, amen. In Allahumma bismika amutu wa ahya. I'm showered with the cultures of black tea and coffee. And I'm fueled by passion and pride, shown in lines of romantic poetry that can never be translated properly, so we don't even try. In the dancing of Atan and celebrating Eid and in seeing how high our kites can fly. In the way that these two cultures are so similar because we're both family-oriented, respectful, hardworking, and harshly stereotyped. In the way that despite everything, we hold our heads and our flags up high. In the way I kill and die for mine, and I know you would too. I'm showered by the culture of black tea and coffee that have stained mosaic tiles to create different shades of brown that have been carefully placed together to create me. Thank you so much for listening.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
That was Yasmin Rahimi and her poem, Black Tea and Coffee. Anything you'd like to say to listeners today, whether it be, you know, people with Afghan roots, Colombian roots, or combined Latin American roots? There's just so much going on in the world today.
Definitely. With everything going on, I think it's necessary to be kind and be loving, and in that, be proud of who you are and where you come from. Love yourself, love your family, love your friends. You never know what people are going through. You never know what their families are going through. Go through life as positively as you can.
Great words. Might be hard to live by, but we can try every day. Every day is a new day.
Definitely.
Thank you, Yasmin Rahimi, for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
That does it for today's show. I am Sarah Blanco, contributing producer, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein.
And that does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.